I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I suddenly felt a burn in my back, and then when I tried to move, I couldn't.
What happened?
I just remember hearing the sound of an explosion.
No one's claimed responsibility for Wednesday's twin blasts in Iran that killed at least 84 people and came after senior Hamas leader and Iran ally Salah al-Ouri was killed in Beirut a day before in a strike Lebanese officials blame on Israel. We'll speak with Iranian historian Arash Azizi. Then, as Ukraine and Russia exchanged nearly 500 prisoners in the largest prisoner swap of the war, Russian President Vladimir Putin is reportedly signaling behind the scenes he's open to a ceasefire. We'll go to Moscow to speak with New School professor Nina Khrushcheva, who says the West must face reality in Ukraine. And we'll be joined by civil rights leader Bishop William Barber. He's calling for more awareness and justice for disabled people after he was kicked out of a Greenville, North Carolina movie theater on Christmas when he went to see The Color Purple with his 90-year-old mother.
But our plans were interrupted when the managers of the AMC theater here in Greenville chose to call the police rather than accommodate my visible disability.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iran's holding a day of mourning after at least 84 people were killed in a pair of explosions in the city of Kerman on Wednesday. More than 280 people were injured. The blast occurred near the tomb of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, where hundreds of Iranians had gathered to mark the fourth anniversary of his assassination by the United States in Iraq. No one has claimed responsibility for the blast. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has vowed a harsh response. The bombing in Iran came just a day after a top Hamas official, Salah al-Ouri, was assassinated outside of Beirut, Lebanon, in a suspected Israeli strike. His funeral is being held today in Beirut. On Wednesday, Israel also called nine Hezbollah leaders in strikes, killed nine Hezbollah fighters in strikes on southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, a high-ranking commander from an Iranian-backed militia in Iraq was killed earlier today in an airstrike on a militia base in central Baghdad. It's unclear who carried out the strike. The events are increasing fears that Israel's war on Gaza could grow into a regional conflict. On Wednesday, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah said the killing of Salah al-Ouri will not go unpunished.
We extend our congratulations and condolences to our dear brothers and great leader, Sheikh Saleh, deputy leader of Hamas's political office, and his fellow leaders and cadre in the Al-Qassam Brigades and Hamas, who were martyred yesterday in a flagrant Israeli aggression in the southern suburb of Dahiya in Beirut.
In Gaza, Al Jazeera is reporting at least 14 members of a Palestinian family have been killed in an Israeli bombing west of Khan Yunis. Separately, Israel has been accused of bombing an area of the Jabalia refugee camp where residents gathered to collect water. Eyewitnesses said the blast destroyed surrounding buildings and injured several people.
It is a catastrophe. It is a massacre. No man can understand what is happening. The place was bombed. The place is for water collection. People were getting water. This is why it happened. Any area that supports people, the Israelis target it. All water stations in the strip were targeted.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have detained hundreds of Palestinians during a 30-hour military raid on the Nur Shams refugee camp. Meanwhile, the International Court of Justice has announced it'll hold 2 days of public hearings, beginning on January 11th, in response to South Africa's case accusing Israel of committing genocide acts in Gaza. A senior official in the U.S. Department of Education has resigned to protest the Biden administration's support for Israel's war on Gaza. Tara Kabash, who's a Palestinian-American Christian, wrote in his resignation letter, quote, "I cannot stay silent as this administration turns a blind eye to the atrocities committed against innocent Palestinian lives in what leading human rights experts have called a genocidal campaign by the Israeli government." Tara Kabash appeared on CNN Wednesday night.
There are people throughout the government, throughout this administration, who have repeatedly tried to use every avenue available to them to raise concerns because they care about this country, they care about this president, and they care about our democracy. And I think what the president is doing by ignoring the will of the people and by ignoring all of these individuals who have continuously supported his agenda, I think it's undermining our democratic ideals, and it's undermining America.
Tara Kabash was a Biden appointee. In related news, 17 current staffers on Biden's reelection campaign have anonymously signed a letter urging the president to support a Gaza ceasefire. They wrote, quote, "Complicity in the death of over 20,000 Palestinians, 8,200 of whom are children, simply cannot be justified," unquote. Meanwhile, in California, hundreds of Jewish activists and their allies shut down the California state capitol in Sacramento Wednesday, demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. The United States and 11 other nations issued a joint statement Wednesday threatening to take further military action against Houthi forces from Yemen if they continue to target shipping vessels in the Red Sea. The statement said in part, quote, "The Houthis will bear the responsibility of the consequences should they continue to threaten lives, the global economy, and free flow of commerce in the region's critical waterways," unquote. The Houthis, who are aligned with Iran, have vowed to keep targeting ships linked to Israel until Israel stops its attacks on Gaza. Ukraine and Russia have exchanged nearly 500 prisoners in the largest prisoner swap since Russia invaded Ukraine nearly 2 years ago. 230 Ukraine POWs were exchanged for 248 Russians. The United Arab Emirates helped mediate the deal. We'll have more on the war in Ukraine after headlines. The U.S. Justice Department has sued the state of Texas over a new state law that empowers police to arrest anyone they suspect of entering the United States without authorization. The law was signed last month by Texas's Republican Governor Greg Abbott. In related news, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson traveled to Eagle Pass, Texas, with about 60 Republican Congress members Wednesday. He threatened again to block U.S. funding for the war in Ukraine unless the Biden administration intensifies its crackdown on immigrants and asylum seekers.
If President Biden wants a supplemental spending bill focused on national security, it better begin by defending America's national security. It begins right here on our southern border.
In reproductive rights news, a federal appeals court ruled Texas hospitals and emergency room doctors can legally refuse to perform abortions, even if needed to save the life of the patient. The Fifth Circuit Court eschewed federal guidelines for care, siding instead with the state of Texas and anti-abortion groups, which sued the Biden administration for rules it claimed would, quote, force abortion and override state laws. The Center for Reproductive Rights, which represents providers, said, quote, "The state's strategy has been to circumvent the court system and the Constitution itself in order to push abortion out of reach for as many Texans as possible," unquote. Former Harvard President Claudine Gay, who resigned Tuesday, has revealed she faced death threats and was repeatedly called the N-word in recent weeks as a right-wing effort to oust her intensified over her handling of campus protests and her past academic research. Claudine Gay had become Harvard's first Black president just 6 months ago. She's the daughter of Haitian immigrants. In an op-ed in the New York Times, she wrote, quote, "They recycled tired racial stereotypes about Black talent and temperament. They pushed a false narrative of indifference and incompetence." She also wrote, quote, "This was merely a single skirmish in a broader war to unravel public faith and pillars of American society," unquote. Hundreds of pages of court documents related to the deceased convicted sex trafficker and financier Jeffrey Epstein have been unsealed. One notable document is a deposition from one of Epstein's survivors who said Prince Andrew had groped her at Epstein's Manhattan apartment. The woman also says Epstein talked about former President Bill Clinton, quote, "He said one time, Clinton likes them young, referring to girls," unquote. The deposition also referenced a time when Epstein discussed a possible visit with then future President Donald Trump in Atlantic City. Other notable names mentioned in the unsealed documents include Michael Jackson, the attorney Alan Dershowitz, and late former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, and the magician David Copperfield. More documents are expected to be unsealed soon. And in Newark, New Jersey, an imam was shot and killed outside his mosque early Wednesday morning. Hassan Sharif was headed to the Masjid Muhammad Mosque for morning prayers. Authorities are searching for his killer. New Jersey authorities say there's no indication yet that the shooting was motivated by bias or that it was an act of terrorism. The imam had also been attacked outside the mosque in August. The New Jersey chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, praised Hassan Sharif as being a, quote, beacon of leadership in his community. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Iran is observing a national day of mourning as the death toll from twin explosions Wednesdays has reached 84, with many others injured. The blasts in south-central Kerman province killed attendees to a memorial for top Revolutionary Guards General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike 4 years ago in Iraq. This is a survivor who was being treated in a nearby hospital.
I suddenly felt a burn in my back, and then when I tried to move, I couldn't.
What happened?
I just remember hearing the sound of an explosion.
No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but Iran has placed blame on Israel and the U.S. The White House said the Islamic State could be behind the bloody bombings and rejected claims Israel or the U.S. was involved. The tragedy comes amid mounting fears that Israel's war on Gaza could lead to a wider regional conflict. One day before the blast, a senior Hamas leader and Iran ally, Saleh al-Aruri, was killed in a strike in southern Beirut, which Lebanese officials blamed on Israel. And earlier today, a drone strike killed 4 members of an Iranian-backed Iraqi militia in Baghdad. Iraqi authorities have blamed the U.S.-led international coalition for the attack.
For more, we're joined by Arash Azizi, Iranian historian and writer. His book is titled The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. His recent piece in The Nation is headlined, in The National, is headlined, "Who are the likely suspects in the Kerman blasts, and what does this mean for Iran?" His forthcoming book out next is titled What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom. Thanks so much for joining us, Arash Azizi. Can you start off by talking about the significance of these two attacks in Iran? No one has yet claimed responsibility, but what you think this looks like.
These are really terrible attacks. If you look at the death toll, although the death toll is actually being readjusted lower now, now it's between 80s and 90s, but it still makes it one of the deadliest, if not the deadliest attack of its kind in recent history, perhaps even sort of modern Iranian history. So they're truly terrible. And of course, they do come at a time when the region is very tense. There's been a shadow war between Iran and Israel and the United States for many years now, but especially in the last few months. And the anniversary of Soleimani's killing 4 years ago is already a very tense stay because, you know, it involves a lot of groups in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Iran, and, you know, Israel, Syria. A lot of them are linked to Soleimani in one way or the other. So it's a very tense time, and the attack comes at that time. Now, it is true that we don't really know who did the attack yet. No one has really claimed it yet. A lot of experts that I've spoken to and myself looking at the existing evidence believe that it's sort of the likely culprit, in my opinion, is to be the Islamic State, particularly its group, its regional group based in Afghanistan, known as ISIS Khorasan, Khorasan province. And this is a group that, because of the kind of attacks that it did, kind of a mass civilian killing, because of the, you know, putting the bombs in briefcases and you know, some of the more, you know, some of the more specific methods used and the targets that they've picked, this makes them to be the most likely culprit that have committed the attacks.
So, Arash, can you explain, I mean, you've written this book on Qasem Soleimani, the significance of this attack taking place on the day, the fourth anniversary of his death, as people were gathering in his burial place where his body is. But why would the Islamic State, as you said, Islamic State Khorasan, why would they, what would be the incentive for them to carry out an attack now in the midst, as you say, of the what's going on in Gaza, just the attack now in Kerman taking place just a day after Al-Aruri was assassinated in Beirut? Why Islamic State?
You know, it's likely that they might have planned this attack long ago. It might have also been more recent, but certainly longer than Aruri's assassination. So it might not be directly sort of related to that. So they probably planned it a while ago. Now, this group has tried to gain power in Afghanistan in recent years. They are also an adversary of the Taliban regime there, which they see it as some sort of a tacit alliance with Iran, although the Taliban regime and the Islamic Republic of Iran have a complicated relationship, but they've sometimes worked together in the last couple of years, although Iran doesn't even officially recognize it as the government of Afghanistan. But this group has tried to raise its profile. That's one thing. And also, they regard Soleimani as the leader of this Shia force that they consider as an enemy, as sort of a symbol of Shia Islam and the symbol of the Islamic Republic, and also a sort of symbol of Iran in this sense. They regard it as such. So it would make sense for them to attack it. Although I would say the fact that they haven't taken responsibility yet does give me a bit of pause, because if they did it, you know, why wouldn't they already take responsibility for it? And there's possibility that there might be other groups and smaller groups, but again, if it's them, why haven't they taken responsibility? So that's one question that a lot of us are asking right now. I should also say that the National Security Council of Iran met this morning, Iranian time, and, you know, after the meeting, they issued a statement in which they're also very clear that they also don't know who committed the attacks yet, and that they put sort of the first priority in finding out who did the attacks, who are behind it. So while, you know, the Iranian officials in broad terms condemn Israel and the U.S. as sort of enemies that are behind troubles against Iran, as they always do, they haven't actually, the bodies like the Supreme National Security Council, haven't pointed direct fingers as who would be the perpetrator. And, you know, they have promised, of course, to act against whoever did the attacks.
And Arash, the people who were killed, as we said, about 84, you said somewhere between 80 and 90 people, none of those people were in any way associated with the government, the Revolutionary Guard, because as you've said also, I mean, when they've been attacks perpetrated by either the U.S., Israel, as you say in your piece, has carried out many operations in Iran, but they tend to be targeted against specific people. I mean, most notably the series of assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists. But in this case, who was among the dead?
That's right. They usually target either IRGC officials, this militia that really rules things in Iran, or the nuclear scientists. And do they have a specific attacks, they specific targets, which in this case, there doesn't seem to have been any, even a sort of a mid-ranking IRGC official there. So that makes it, in my opinion, less likely that it was an attack by them, although not impossible, but much less likely. So in terms of who was the who were the victims, from what we can see so far, you know, ordinary people, ordinary civilians. Yes, a lot of them might have been there to mourn Qasem Soleimani in some ways. But I should also say this is a big cemetery in the, you know, in Kerman, where it's my maternal city. You know, I've been to this cemetery many times. There are tons of ordinary people who are buried there. In fact, it was Mother's Day in Iran also around that day. So many people might have been just going to their mother's grave, as is customary on such a day. We see a large number of children are among the killed and the injured, dozens, which really shows the kind of victims that this attack had, and also first responders who came, because this was a double blast. So the first responders who came to help with the victims of the first blast, unfortunately, were killed in the second blast, which is another sort of a signature of ISIS, and makes it more likely to be that. Although, as I said, we really don't know, and it's a bit of a speculation at this point.
And Arash Azizi, remind us how Qasem Soleimani died and his significance.
Soleimani was killed in a drone strike on January 3rd, 2020, ordered by President Trump at the time, which was a really shocking action. Just to give you an idea, a few years before, during the Bush administration, when the Bush administration was trying to kill a Hezbollah leader, they repeatedly, at least once, postponed the attack just to make sure they don't hit Soleimani. And that's why. That's because he was easily one of the most powerful men in the Middle East. He was, you could easily say, he was the most powerful military figure in Iran at the time. His official job title, he was the head of the Quds Force, or the Jerusalem Force, which is basically the external operations wings of the IRGC. What he really did was that he controlled a very large multinational army of Afghans, Syrians, Iraqis, Lebanese, all around the region, and had really commanded and directed Islamic Republic's interventions in countries of the region. So he was of a big significance, and also he was a ranking official of a nation state, called the Islamic Republic of Iran. So it was sort of highly unusual to assassinate a figure like that in a strike. Some people would say not since the Second World War, when the United States helped kill a Japanese admiral, had such a figure of another country been targeted like that. Of course, the official sort of explanations for it was that there have been tons of attacks by forces directed by Soleimani, this group based in Iraq, on U.S. forces, and this has been going on. Even in the last few months, we've seen more than 100 attacks by these forces by these sort of Iraqi forces aligned with Tehran on U.S. forces. So that was that was one official reason. The other being that the IRGC was put on the terror group list by the Trump administration. So they regarded Soleimani as having a double role, as on one side being a sort of a uniformed official of Iran, but at the same time they saw it as a leading figure in what they considered a terror organization. So that's why they did the attack.
Let me ask you about Syed Razi Mousavi, who right around Christmas, an Israeli airstrike outside the Syrian capital Damascus killed a senior advisor of the Iran Revolutionary Guard. The sources told Reuters the advisor was responsible for coordinating the military alliance between Syria and Iran. And apparently he was with, right, Qasem Soleimani when Soleimani was killed. Now he has been killed.
That's right. Syed Razi Mousavi was perhaps, I would say, easily the most important, definitely one of the top three IRGC officials, this sort of Iranian militia officials in Syria. And he'd been in Syria a very long time. He people would know him in Damascus. He'd played a important role in the Syrian civil war. Effectively, this is when the government of Syria, Bashar Assad, helped kill hundreds of thousands of his own civilians, and Iran and IRGC were helping him. So Syed Razi had an important role there, but he really, even years before, he had effectively been based in Syria since the 1990s. Late 1990s, I would say, for sure. He would go back and forth, but at some point he was entirely based there. His wife taught at the Iranian school in Damascus, so he was an old-timer. When the Iranian intervention really increased in the aftermath of the Syrian revolution followed by the civil war, that's in 2011 and 12, Syed Razi became this old guy who could help everybody else there because he'd just been there such a long time. So his assassination, which just happened recently, was very important since it was, it signaled Israel and the U.S. probably sort of targeting a really high-value Iranian target in Damascus, and which really escalates things given the conditions that we are in. And also possibly points out to Israel having something like what it did in the aftermath in the 1970s of the Munich attacks, which, you know, in the aftermath of that in the 1970s, Israel started an operation, usually known as Operation Wrath of God, in which it went around and killed a lot of leaders of groups that were in some way or the other linked to the terror Munich attacks. So the killing of Aruri, Said Razi, and others might show that Israel has a similar quest.
Arash Azizi, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Iranian historian and writer. His book, The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions, will link to your piece in The National, who are the likely suspects in the Kerman blast, and what does this mean for Iran? Forthcoming book out next month, What Iranians Want, Women, Life, Freedom. He's speaking to us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Next up, as Ukraine and Russia have the largest prisoner of war exchange since Russia invaded Ukraine, the Russian president is reportedly signaling behind the scenes he's open to a ceasefire. We'll go to Moscow to speak with Nina Khrushcheva, who says the West must face reality in Ukraine. Stay with us.
Everything's permitted. Nothing's really true. Live outside the line, boys. Do what you do. Nothing's as it seems. You can't.
I Feel So Lonely by Primal Scream. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.
On Wednesday, Ukraine and Russia exchanged nearly 500 prisoners in the largest prisoner swap since Russia invaded Ukraine nearly 2 years ago. 230 Ukrainian prisoners were exchanged for 248 Russians. The United Arab Emirates helped mediate the deal. This comes after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia fired 500 missiles and drones against Ukraine in just 5 days. Zelensky spoke Tuesday night.
Since the beginning of today, there have been almost 100 missiles of various types, and the trajectories have been specifically calculated by the enemy to cause as much damage as possible. This is absolutely conscious terror.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin vowed to intensify attacks inside Ukraine after a Ukrainian attack on the Russian city of Belgorod killed at least 25 people, including 5 children, on Saturday. He spoke during a meeting with wounded soldiers at a military hospital in Moscow.
We, too, want to end the conflict as quickly as possible, only on our terms. We have no desire to fight indefinitely, but we are not going to give up our position either.
Last month, the New York Times reported Putin has been signaling through his intermediaries behind the scenes that he's open to a ceasefire in Ukraine. For more, we're joined in Moscow by Nina Khrushcheva, professor of international affairs at the New School, the great-granddaughter of the former Soviet premier Nikita Khrushchev. She's the author of The Lost Khrushchev, Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind, and co-author of In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. Her recent article for Project Syndicate is titled The West Must Face Reality in Ukraine. Professor Khrushcheva, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's start off with the latest, the last week. Putin's intensifying attacks on Ukraine more than he ever has since the beginning of the war. Yet we get behind the scenes, the New York Times is reporting, he's signaling that he's interested in a ceasefire. And then you've got this largest prisoner of war swap since the war began. Put it all together for us.
Thank you. Good morning. Well, these are not connected incidents, I'd say. The attacks on Ukraine, the largest since the beginning, also in some ways followed the very large attack or attacks in the last two weeks, I guess, on the Russian territory, because the Ukrainian forces also have been shooting, I think it was one day, it was 300 missiles. So it has been going on escalating. And the reason it has been happening is we heard so much about Ukrainian counteroffensive really didn't work out as it was hoped. Then the aid from the United States and Europe somewhat is stalling. And so Ukraine was showing that it's fighting. So, of course, as Putin always does, the Russians fight back. So that's what we've been seeing. As far as the New York Times reporting on signaling on negotiations, that's not how we see it here, because they mean some signs and winks, but Putin has been quite clear almost from the beginning, that Russia is going to achieve all its goals. So Russia is, especially now when they're